Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby, and joining me is Claire White.
Hi.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We are here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today we are talking about the big book of science fiction.
Yay!
Came out on July 12th of 2016, and it's a compilation of science fiction short stories and excerpts from other science fiction works, and was compiled by Jeff and Anne Vandermeer. There's over 100 stories in this, and Claire actually has the word count.
It's over 700,000 words.
It's a lot of words, yeah.
It's like a 5-pound book.
Yeah, it's huge.
We both lugged it around.
We lugged it around on the subways of New York City. It was pretty fun.
That's our dedication to the podcast. Yes.
So obviously Claire and I were not able to read all 700,000 words of this story.
Yet.
We will, because we both really, spoilers, it's really good. We liked it. But we did.
What's the point of listening to the podcast
now,
Kyle?
They'll never, we got to hook them. No. But we did read three specific stories. The very first story in the book, which is by H.G. Wells, it's called The Star. It was written in 1898, and it kind of, just to summarize it, it's real quick. You can read it in a second, but just summarize it. It's kind of about Earth going through a catastrophe.
The whole of Earth going through a natural disaster.
Yeah. Something hurtling through space. Really messes up Earth. And then we also read the last two stories in the book, which the second to last story is called The Slinks. It was written in 2000 by Tatiana Tolstaya. And she's a Russian author who, this is one of her first stories translated into English. And she's also related to Tolstoy. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
No, never. Sounds piddly.
And the last story in the book, which came out in 2002, is called Baby Doll, and that was written by Joanna Sinisalo, and she's a Finnish author, also doesn't have a lot of English translations. That's right. One of the cool things about this sci-fi collection is it's a lot of authors who have never been translated into English. It's people from all over the world.
Right, and the last two books, The Slinks is about after the nuclear explosion in Russia.
Yeah, the nuclear holocaust.
And then Baby Doll is about...
the potential near future?
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So Claire will be telling us about the production side of the book and how Jeff and Anne Vandermeer went around collecting all these stories and what they used to pick what they wanted. And I will be doing a brief history of science fiction and the themes that really started in the early science fiction works and how those themes are still present in science fiction works today.
Well, take it away, Kyle.
All right, so I will take it away with posing the question, how would you define science fiction? Because there's so many different subcategories in science fiction, and I feel like it often sparks argument as to what is and what isn't science fiction.
Even within the science fiction community.
Yeah, especially within the science fiction community, I feel like. I have a light argument with our producer about how I don't think Star Wars is really science fiction.
I feel like it gets very heated.
It can get heated. one of the funniest definitions of sci-fi that I found was that... sci-fi is like pornography. You can't define it, but you know it when you see it. And according to Wiki, science fiction is a genre of speculative fiction dealing with imaginative concepts such as futuristic science and technology, space travel, time travel, faster-than-light travel, parallel universes, and extraterrestrial life. Yeah, I don't really like that definition either. To me, it feels a little soulless. I mean, granted, it's off Wiki, so...
but Wiki is everything. Wiki it knows everything.
That's true. But to me, science fiction is a lot about kind of ideas that run against the norm of now and an examination of our culture and what it might become. And then also our relationship with technology.
So, and that's your personal definition of sci-fi.
Yeah, that's my own personal definition of sci-fi and just what it means to me. And I love sci-fi. It actually does mean a lot to me. So I want to focus on three specific authors, mostly two, really, I'll get in depth with, but there is a third that are, in my mind, kind of the founders of science fiction. In a lot of people's minds, they toss these names around as the starters of sci-fi. And those three are H.G. Wells, which I'll get into, Mary Shelley, which I'll also get into, and Jules Verne, which I'll, he deserves a mention. The big reason I won't be mentioning him is because we're relating these authors back to the stories in the big book of sci-fi that we read, and he doesn't his fingerprints aren't necessarily on those stories as much as Shelley and Wells.
Right. Doesn't mean he can't appear in another podcast.
Definitely not. Jules Verne, we love you. talking to you from beyond the grave. So let me start with Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley was born in England in 1797, and she's often seen as the straight-up founder of science fiction with her incredible work, Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus.
Right, which some people don't even consider science fiction.
Some people don't, but in my eyes it is, and I think a lot of other people's eyes it is. It was written in 1818, so it's old. I've heard arguments say that science fiction was started with, like, the Epic of Gilgamesh or some of the Hindu epics of, like, Ramayana.
That's kind of pushing it.
That's pushing it. I think those are more mythos. So, to me, Frankenstein is the first science fiction novel. Now, Frankenstein, of course, we all know the story. Scientist creates a creature out of dead tissue. Creature runs amok and ends up killing the scientist and other people. One of the big themes of Frankenstein is that technology, when left unchecked, can often turn around and cause mayhem, and can, you know, the creature that kills its creator. And I want to say that Mary Shelley was by no means an anti-technologist. Like, she wasn't someone who was like, ugh, the dastardly technology.
I feel like that's what people take from Frankenstein. I haven't read it.
Yeah.
I've seen Young Frankenstein. But I feel like that's, like, the moral from it.
That is the quote-unquote moral, but that's not what Shelley intended. She was trying to write a horror story, and that's a whole other thing we could get into, but we won't. And she was just trying to write a scary story using technology. So she was not an anti-technologist for all those Shelley naysayers. She was actually a very radical thinker for her time. So not only did Frankenstein sort of, I don't want to say invent, because this whole creator getting killed by its creation is I'm sure even older than Frankenstein, but she really put that into the public mind and public consciousness. She also invented the mad scientist trope.
No, that was Mary Shelley?
Yeah, Dr. Frankenstein was the first mad scientist.
Whoa!
Yeah, there'd been, like, mad magicians and spirits and stuff before, but he was using science to make creations that were scaring people, and that was a first.
Oh, my goodness.
Props to you,
yeah,
Mary Shelley.
Yeah, that'll continue for, like, the rest of Western civilization. Yeah.
The Frankenstein mythos has been permeating pop culture since its creation in 1818. Keep in mind, 1818, that was over 200 years ago. Or no, not quite. Almost 200 years ago. Math. But you even see these Frankenstein stories in modern-day blockbusters other than just Frankenstein the movie. Jurassic Park is a Frankenstein story.
Yeah.
The Terminator is a Frankenstein
story. Yeah,
that's story.
What my first thought was.
Yeah. You make these creations and they come back to kill you. The Matrix, you could say, is a Frankenstein story. I also want to note that Shelley wrote the first post-apocalyptic novel in 1826 called The Last Man, and it's about a plague, because they didn't have nuclear weapons to cause their apocalypse at the time, but it's about a plague that devastates the world's population, and it's left with just one man alive, essentially.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mary Shelley's done so much for science fiction and writing, and she's had a really fascinating life, and I would love to get more into it, because it's really, really cool and interesting. But we only have so much time, so I need to move on to Mr. H.G. Wells.
Mm.
Now, H.G. Wells wrote the first story that we read in the big book of science fiction called The Star.
I can talk about what I felt about it later.
Claire, spoiler again, Claire liked it. and The Star was written in 1898. Wells himself was born in 1866, and Wells was a bit of a different sort of writer than his contemporary Jules Verne, where Jules Verne would get very into schematics and his science fiction was about pushing the technology of the time and to new heights. Like, he was shooting a rocket to the moon.
This is
Jules Verne. He was going 20,000 leagues under the sea.
Right.
And it was very, like, he would even draw out schematics for the technology he was using in these books. Now, H.G. Wells was a lot different. His science fiction and fantastical writing was more about reflecting on societal norms. And he was actually really trying to subvert cultural norms through the fantastic. He was tricking
people. Some more political.
Yeah. He was tricking people into reading his science fiction books, and they were getting new ideas about what should and shouldn't be happening, like about colonialism and about industrialization and about workers' rights. And he was slipping that sort of stuff into his books so that people would read them and then start to think about these things. Mary Shelley was also doing the same sort of thing, like putting subversive ideas into her work. She was a radical thinker. She was very much against women needing to be married, like if they had a kid, like child out of wedlock. She thought that women should have a choice. And people say they see that in a lot of her work. So science fiction, man, pushing ideas.
Of love and technology.
Of love and technology, of socialism and what have you. Wells's sci-fi often had to do with exploring other alien cultures. And I mean alien as in, like, foreign to us. Not necessarily, they weren't necessarily aliens. Sometimes they were people from the future. Sometimes they were aliens.
Oh, okay. I assumed, actually, alien
was
alien.
Yeah. And he was examining common morality in his books and, like, trying to throw out different ideas about it. He was also one of the early writers, I think, of human unexceptionalism. When you read The Star, you really feel like humans aren't that important.
You definitely feel that.
Yeah, and it's a really great short story. So we'll get to that at the end as well.
Spoiler,
I liked it too. So let me give you some list of some of his most famous works. He wrote The Time Machine in 1895, and that's about a man who invents a time machine, goes forward in time, and it's kind of an exploration of the future society where a leisure class exists on the surface of the Earth and live kind of cushy lives but are all really stupid, like they don't have any original ideas. And there's a smarter working class that live underground and kind of keep the world powered. And then he finds out that the working class is kind of raising the leisure class like cattle and is using them for food. They're eating them. Yeah, it's pretty dark stuff. But you know, there's a lot of themes there of like rights of the worker and what might happen if you know, the leisure class keeps oppressing people. That
sounds like someone who's very mad at the British upper class.
He wrote the Island of Dr. Moreau in 1896, and that's about a doctor who goes to a secluded island where he conducts experiments trying to turn animals into people, make animals more human-like, and the animals eventually turn on him and kill him.
Sounds like Frankenstein.
Yeah, it's your classic Frankenstein story. The Invisible Man, he wrote in 1897, and that's about a guy, a scientist who accidentally turns himself invisible, and he can't grasp it and deal with it, so he starts to murder people. And then The War of the Worlds was written in 1898, same year as The Star, and that's about Martians invading Earth, and it has a lot to do, actually, with English colonialism at the time. You know, this is during the Victorian era, and England was everywhere, had their fingers all over the world.
It's funny, I've heard of every single one of those books, have read none of them.
Yeah, the first Wells story I ever read was The Star, which is the one we did for this, and it was great, and it makes me really want to read these. The list of what to read keeps going.
I know.
Getting bigger and bigger.
We thought with this podcast we'd be reading what we wanted to read, but now we're just making more things that we want to read.
So obviously The Star by H.G. Wells has a lot of his own work and themes in it. But I really wanted to kind of pull back and examine how H.G. Wells and Mary Shelley influenced The Sphinx by Tatiana Tolstoya and Baby Doll by Joanna Sinisalo. So The Sphinx, like we said before, deals with a post-apocalyptic Russia. And to me, like, I see a lot of Shelley's theme in there in that humans have created this monster, these nuclear weapons, and the monster eventually turns on them and kills them. But you could also look at it from an H.G. Wells perspective of exploring a new culture, because in The Sphinx, it's about, you know, the new kind of way that people live in Russia after the apocalypse and how... How would we deal with this? And how old Russian folktales are kind of coming about as, like, fact again. Like, they're no longer folktales.
They're fact, like they used to be.
Like they used to be, exactly. And Baby Doll, my goodness, that story did things to me. It's the last story in the book. It's by the Finnish author, Sinisalo. And to me, also rings true with Frankenstein in that the Baby Doll to me was a horror story. And Frankenstein was a horror story. And in Baby Doll, you're kind of looking at where society is going, and it's created this terrible world.
It's horrible.
And I look at that, I'm like, is this the monster that we're creating right now as society, like, starts to over-sexualize people even more and more as the years go on? Is that what we're going to go to? So to me, that felt like a Frankenstein story, like, 100%. It was nightmarish. And I really hope that's not where we end up. I don't want to spoil the story too much. You guys should really read it because it was incredible. So that's what I have for a brief history of sci-fi. Obviously, we could
go on for days.
Go on for days about a lot of these topics. There's so much there. This is such a meaty thing. But Claire, what can you tell us about putting this book together? Because it's a fascinating book.
Yeah, it's amazing. It was compiled by Anne Vandermeer and Jeff Vandermeer. They're married. And they're also rock stars in the sci-fi, fantasy, horror genre. Anne Vandermeer is regarded as one of the best editors in the field. She is the former editor-in-chief of Weird Tales, which is a horror magazine, and she won a Hugo Award for that.
Oh, nice.
Hugo Awards, for those who don't know, are a set of awards given annually for the best science fiction and fantasy works and achievements. And I think they're pretty much the highest awards for those as you can go. And there's a bunch, because I'm going to mention a bunch. She's the founder of Silver Web Magazine, which is devoted to experimental and avant-garde fantasy literature. She has won like insane amounts of awards, the British Fantasy Award, the Riesling Award. Like, she just seems to be very respected and well-regarded.
Her trophy case is very full.
Yeah, on her bookshelf, I'm sure. Her husband, Jeff Vandermeer, is he's a writer. He's best known for the Southern Reach trilogy. It's a sci-fi trilogy.
I've never heard of it.
I haven't either, but apparently it's good. He's written over 11 books. He's a New York Times bestselling author. And he's won, again, a huge amount of awards for his writing in fantasy and sci-fi. The Nebula Award, the Riesling Award, the British Fantasy Award, the BSFA Award, the World Fantasy Award. And he's been nominated for a Hugo Award.
I didn't even know half these awards exist.
I didn't either. And I mean, they're all like best fantasy written in Britain, best fantasy in America. They're all subgenres of that.
Canada.
But basically, they're two people who are very respected, very talented, know a lot about the sci-fi and fantasy world.
And are elbow deep in science fiction.
Yeah, or coming out of it now. Together, they have edited countless anthologies. The one they're probably best known for is The New Weird. It's part horror, part speculative fiction that crosses genre boundaries. It's a genre of fiction.
Sounds very H.P. Lovecrafty.
Sounds scary to me. I'm not a horror person at all.
I dig some cosmic horror.
So they have found over the years that editing, making one big book is better than making several smaller anthologies. So with this, they made one big, as we said earlier, over 700,000 word book.
It's huge.
It includes writers from almost 30 countries. Like you said, it begins in 1897 with H.G. Wells and finishes in 2002 with Joanna Cicilano.
Cinesalo.
You've told me how to say that so many times.
Yeah, she's
Can't
Finnish.
Keep it in my head.
She's Finnish.
And those Finnish names.
I need to find more stuff by her because I loved her story.
Spoiler. Sorry, but I can't help the joke. So the couple says they read about 6 or 7 million words of fiction before settling on the contents of the book. So they
so
did their
much.
Research.
Yeah, yeah.
And to go along with that research, they said they found that no one else has been putting in the time and research that they're willing to. So they've kind of found their niche with a commitment to these anthologies and to international fiction and making translations.
Yeah, because a lot of anthologies, you just get the big names. You're like, oh, I got Isaac Asimov in this and Heinlein. And it's just like you get the names that you think will sell it.
Yeah, and instead of just doing the Isaac Asimovs or the H.G. Wells, they feel that by doing more lesser-known writers, it makes more of a statement. And it makes the anthology stronger.
Yeah, it really gives it some depth. And, like, you find that you discover people who you never knew before, which I really enjoy.
Exactly. They also get to kind of define the genre.
Yeah.
If they do that.
It's the big book of science fiction.
We like this one.
We get to pick what stories are in science fiction.
They said when they were looking for a great science fiction story, they're looking for a story that speaks to them on a personal level. So it doesn't matter what the character is. It can be a human, a robot, a rock, a plant, a piece of meat. But they just have to relate to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, they're looking at 100 years of sci-fi. So when they're looking at the older stories, they're making sure that modern audiences can still relate.
Yeah, no, that's a big deal. Because you can read H.G. Wells, which is written over 100 years ago right now, and still enjoy it. But I don't know that you could say that for other authors.
Right. They were trying to avoid fan fiction and some, like, humorous stories that still don't hold up. Like, I was kind of comparing it earlier to comedy shows. Like, if you watch old comedy TV shows, for instance, or even just old comedy movies, sometimes they're not funny.
They're not as funny. You mentioned Cheers, right? Cheers isn't as funny now as it was.
There's so many references to, like, the culture at the time. I mean, also another example, I love the TV show 30 Rock, but I don't know if it'll be funny. As funny 20 years from now,
it might not be nearly as good as what it is now.
Yeah, because the jokes are so of the moment.
Yeah, so current and of the times.
Yeah, and they want to, so back to the big book of sci-fi, not 30 Rock. They want to show the entire world of sci-fi. So they have experimental stories in there, surreal stories in there, dystopian, utopian humor. They say the easiest route for sci-fi is to go dystopian, and they were trying really hard to balance everything out.
Because there's so much dystopian sci-fi, and so much really well-respected dystopian sci-fi. 1984, it's Brave New World. Like,
very easy to be pessimistic about the future.
Yeah, it's true.
We were talking earlier about the definition of sci-fi. So Anne and Jeff came to the conclusion that the simplest and most foolproof definition of the genre is that it deals with events of the future, whether it's 5 minutes or 1,000 years from now.
Okay.
Like, when you were asking earlier about what is sci-fi, I felt like I couldn't answer it, because by now that answer has influenced how I think about sci-fi so much. It seems just so sensible.
Yeah.
And they think that the best stories that can come out of science fiction are how we as humans relate to technology versus how we relate to one another.
Okay.
Is what they tended to find.
Juxtaposing those two sorts of ideas.
Yeah, and that this has been a theme throughout sci-fi. I mean, you could say that that's kind of what started it with Mary Shelley defining sci-fi.
That's true.
And in the beginning, it was about factories, and then later it became about robots, and then people being too connected with the internet. So it's always how we're dealing with the newest
technology at this time, and like where it could potentially go, and the pitfalls of that. That's so cool.
Yeah. They also, they were talking about the science fiction from different countries, and it's, I think this is really interesting. They say a lot of great science fiction has come out of Russia in the past few decades because it was a good way for writers in the Soviet Union to tackle issues in a way that wasn't going to get them thrown in prison.
Subverting cultural norms through the fantastic.
H.G. Wells would be proud. They say South American authors are more playful and absurdist.
Yeah,
which,
I kind of see it weirdly.
I know. In my head, it makes sense. I don't know why, but it does. They think that this particular era of sci-fi will be remembered for the flowering of women and women of color writers. They also talked a lot about how the genre is more mainstream today than it was, you know, even 20 years ago.
Oh, definitely. You see so many more science fiction movies, like the Hunger Games, you know, this huge thing in the zeitgeist.
The Christopher Nolan movie, what was it? Interstellar.
Interstellar, yeah.
Doing really well at the box office. And they credit... give a lot of credit to authors like Margaret Atwood, who wrote The Handmaid's Tale. And that I read that in school, and that was given to me as good fiction, not great sci-fi. It was just, this is good fiction. Yeah, it is sci-fi. But because that was so popular, more publishers were willing to take the chance on sci-fi, so it opened the doors for other books to come through. Also, this wasn't their idea, but this was something that came up in an interview that I listened to with them, that millennials, this whole generation was raised on Harry Potter and the fantastical.
It all comes back to Harry Potter.
J.K. Rowling, you have changed the world. So this generation is more open to the fantastical.
Yeah, and you could definitely see that in comic book movies too, I feel like. And maybe they're also a product of Harry Potter doing well, but just that they're science fiction in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Captain America and S.H.I.E.L.D. with
all
this future
technology.
Well, kind
of not, according to Anne and Jeff Vandermeer, because that's dealing with the now. It's a story about now, not the future.
Yeah, but it still exists in, like, an alternate world, and they're traveling through space, and there's technology that we don't have now. It's, like, future tech.
But that could be fantasy.
I guess. I don't know. I disagree.
This is an argument for another podcast meeting.
We need more stuff to derail our meetings.
To segue into fantasy... they are hoping to do the big book of classic fantasy and the big book of modern fantasy, which I would love to read.
Yeah, those two are definitely rock stars if they're making compilations of, like, all the best things in the world.
I know. So, Kyle, not to finally get to the right point, but so you liked it, the big book of fantasy?
Big book of sci-fi,
oh,
Claire,
shoot.
You're getting ahead
of
yourself.
I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, I really loved this book, and the fact that it's all these stories from a lot of authors I've never heard of and authors that have never really been translated into English. And they did retranslations for most of them, if not all of them.
They said that actually that was a risk. Like, because you had to get the translation. It costs money.
Yeah.
And you're just hoping it's good, hoping your sources are right.
It's, to me, it's a treasure trove of new, fun stories. And they're short enough that you could read, you know, you could read it in some of them in like 15 minutes. The H.G. Mm-hmm. Wells story.
Super fast.
Was extremely quick and great.
Yeah, I loved that story. That's all Kyle has been hearing me say. Yeah, the past few days is like how good the H.G. Wells story is.
And science fiction, it's just, it's so much more than ray guns and robots and spaceships.
And Star Wars.
And Star Wars. I don't even think it is Star Wars. But, it, you know, it's about pushing limits and being subversive and questioning what we have and what we do right now. And one of the things I really love about it is when you get to go and explore and see other alien, quote-unquote, cultures, even if they're not, like, aliens from space, but you just see, like, new ways that people can live and exist together. And in my eyes, I think about, like, the medieval ages and the Romans and the Renaissance, the Romantic period, how all these countries had all these different governments that we look back on and be like, oh, that government was terrible. But at that time, they thought they had the best system available. And we think we have the best system available right now.
Mm-hmm. So sci-fi
pushes and be like, well, maybe we don't. Maybe look at this system. Look at how these people live.
It kind of is the way people explore that.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're writing an essay on why this is bad.
Yeah.
This is the fun, fantastical way to explore it.
Yeah. And just looking at technologically where humanity can go and like what will get us there. And
yeah. You were saying H.G. Wells was so on the ball.
H.G. Wells predicted so much stuff in his science fiction. He predicted, he's one who first used the term atomic bomb in 1913 before there was an atomic bomb.
Well.
And people, scientists who worked on the atomic bomb cited H.G. Wells as being like, yeah, I read his, you know, we all
I read
know
his
that.
Thing and then I had we this all great know idea.
H.G. Wells had this idea that you would be able to get a small mass of material which you can fit in a handbag and you could split it and it would cause a chain reaction of atoms splitting and it would be an explosion that lasted for days.
He
called it.
He wasn't a scientist, was he?
He was like an amateur biologist, and he dabbled in some sciences, but he was a philosopher mostly and a socialist. But he saw that coming, and people essentially took his science fiction
and made it reality.
He also predicted the internet. He was talking about this engine where you could gather all the written works of the world, and people would be able to access any sort of writing that they ever wanted
through
this engine.
Which is how this podcast exists.
Which is why, because of the internet.
And I'm not as into sci-fi as you are. Like, what makes me really excited and what I grew up really loving was fantasy.
Yeah.
And that's why the Big Book of Fantasy is so appealing. But I am so grateful to have read parts of this anthology and to get to explore this genre. And just the quality, how every story I read was so good. It makes me excited to read more, and I want to read more.
Yeah, and the stories are so digestible. I mean, we've mentioned that before, that they're, a lot of them are short. There's a couple novellas in there, though.
Yeah, I didn't get to any of those yet.
Yeah, but the short stories themselves, they're quick, and they're enriching, and they're really, really enjoyable.
And I love how, like, it in the time that it's in, it kind of gives you a vision of like this particular time,
the era of when it was written.
Yeah,
for
and
sure
the research they put in, it just, I mean, they were talking about their living room just being piles of paper, just like
yeah,
you couldn't get around
it.
I'm just so impressed that they can go through all of this and want to go through all of this and are happy to compile this thing. It's amazing.
You were telling me a cool story about how they had to track down like a Czech diplomat or something like that.
Oh, yeah. This guy had been an editor for a magazine in the old Czech under the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
This Czech sci-fi magazine.
Yeah.
But then now he's a diplomat in the Philippines, but he had all these connections to all these authors.
All these authors that weren't, you know, English that you could.
Yeah. So they were talking about how it was this whole thing of trying to find him and then how to get in contact with him. I mean, the amount of work that they went to is just amazing. I keep on saying that. I'm just so impressed.
Yeah. It's really incredible. Thank you, Anne and Jeff Vandermeer, for like really just working your butts off and like and creating such a great product. And I know it must have been really hard to do, but it's
they
I hope
said they enjoyed
well.
It yeah. They said they loved it.
Yeah, because it's such a great book and I really recommend it. The Big Book of Science Fiction, even if you don't like sci-fi, it's just full of wonderful stories.
If you like good stories, you'll like this book.
Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. We would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes, and you can find the show on Twitter at dsrapodcast. I can be found on Twitter at klex303, that's K-L-E-X-303.
I can be found at Along With Claire, that's C-L-A-I-R-E.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr., that's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R on Twitter. You can learn more about the Big Book of Sci-Fi and some of the articles Claire and I looked up for this podcast on our Facebook page, where we will post them. Our producer, who would be a Sith, not a Jedi, if he had the opportunity, is James Fowey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, who is the sexy robot in Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, and she would be a sexy robot Jedi, I think. Our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, and he would be a Wookiee, but he's the Wookiee that the other Wookiees make fun of because he's not hairy enough, I think.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.